Excellent. Hello, everyone. Joshua Gilliland here, one of the founding lawyers of the Legal Geeks. And I'm here with friends because we need to have a group session to talk about The Mandalorian Season 2, Episode 1, The Marshal. America needs to heal. And this is the beginning of that healing process because The Mandalorian can bring us all together the way that Baby Yoda has touched everyone's hearts. Sure, we have to save the child, but we could call him Baby Lucas. But again, let's just focus on what we got. With me tonight, since I'm at work for trial prep, is Nari Ely, Gabby Martin, and Thomas Harper. They're all East Coast. How's everyone doing? Starting with Nari, then Gabby, then Thomas.
Doing pretty good. We tested our emergency notification system at work today because we are expecting potential disruptions next week. So I'm based in Washington, D.C., so it'll be a fun ride for the next several days.
Oh, we'll stay safe, America. Gabby, are you in mortal danger?
I am not in mortal danger. I am in emotional danger with 4 days left in CT politics. But Star Wars has not only crossed over here in this world, but it's also the majority leader of the House of Representatives costume this year. So we are big Star Wars fans over here in the Nutmeg State.
That is exceptional. And did that get tweeted out? Is there social media of his costume?
Probably. It should be newsworthy. Yes, he did his entire family all Star Wars theme. Even the dog.
He should earn an automatic next term just based on that. There's no need for another election. Like, he just gets one free pass.
Exactly.
I know it's democracy and all, but you know.
Just because word vote delivered.
I love democracy.
I will say that I have been bottled up all day waiting to talk about this episode and not wanting to spoil it for folks that haven't gotten a chance to see it yet. Presumably, everyone who's listening to this has watched it at least once, maybe 50 times. Josh, you say that the Mandalorian heals. Well, this episode heals with a lot of explosions and laser blasts, so I'm excited to talk about it.
And Baby Yoda peeking out of many different angles.
That's right.
I think this Friday morning just healed Thomas, just being able to like wake up and say new Mandalorian today.
That's exactly
for
right.
First time.
I watched it. Granted, I stayed up till 11 to see like if it dropped early, and there were teases on Disney Plus with saying 2 seasons, but it hadn't dropped yet. And I thought I gotta go to bed. I'm tired. And woke up at 3 and I thought like, no, I'm still groggy. Now's not the right time to watch it. Opened my eyes at 4. No, not yet. 5 o'clock was. And Thomas had already texted. So I woke up, started the day with a text from Thomas. So
I paused briefly to consider whether to text you that early. And I was like, yes. The answer is yes. So you did get a courtesy pause, but it was like a millisecond.
It'd be weird not to. it's like I love, you know, Star Trek, and I, you know, like watching Discovery or Lower Decks. I can wait till after work. Mandalorian makes me act like I was 4 years old in 1978, getting up super early to watch cartoons before dawn that were specialty niche ones. I'm 46. That's, and I know I'm not alone in doing that. So it's just such a beautiful, fun show that's written by people who love Star Wars, who know how Star Wars works, and they just swing for the fences, and it is glorious.
And we will definitely get into this, and I just want to like add to that I have been blown away in season one, but in the opening episode of season two also, in how well they know and appreciate and find ways to highlight like lore that's already there and that like real big Star Wars nerds will recognize things. And they're not just, you know, making stuff up off the back of the napkin. They're actually going back into all of this rich art that's already been done and pulling the things out of there to make their story.
It's amazing. It is absolutely amazing what they do. And I love them for it. And well, let's just out of curiosity, Nari, what time did you watch?
I actually watched when I got back from work. I plan to watch it a second time as soon as we're done podcasting about this. So.
Gabby?
I watched it at like 5:30 when I first woke up with breakfast. And then I actually watched it again probably like an hour and a half ago.
Okay. All actions I consider normal, and it'd be strange not to. Did any of you see the Mando Monday on StarWars.com that they did that was live stream on Facebook? Judging by Nari's expression, no. Same with Gabby. Thomas,
I caught bits and pieces, and then I caught the product reveals afterward.
I was working doing, you know, trial prep, so I didn't watch much other than just like, you know, the first 10 minutes because I was able to do that. But I was, Espinoza, who plays Moff Gideon, oh my God, he seems so cool. You know, the yes. fact he did a tutorial on how to hold the Darksaber, I want to party with him. You know, he just plays bad guys, but he seems like the life of the party. He just like nice.
He seems like the nicest guy. Like, I think that's part of what like makes him being a bad guy so good is because like generally he seems like the nicest person you'd ever meet.
With the behind scenes footage of filming season one. And he's like the cheerleader with all the guys from the 501st and their stormtrooper. Come on, party with him.
And I just recently watched and caught up on The Boys on Amazon Prime, where he is sort of one of the head corporate honchos of the evil corporation that owns all these superheroes. And he's equally dastardly in that show. And to know that he's just like so delightful as a normal human being makes it that much better.
He's doing a press tour because he's awesome. So yes. Well, let's get into the legal analysis because we could, as fans, we could just gush for hours, and lawyers, this is what we do. So just out of the gate, and we'll take a little of this out of chronological order. We have the Mandalorian, when he meets the marshal and he realizes that, hey, that armor looks familiar to all of the nerds. And since the marshal's not a Mandalorian, he just bartered for the armor, the Mandalorian demands it back. So, and it's discussed later that, you know, ancestral home was part of the reason why it needed to be traded back. Nari, could you enlighten us on what's the justification for that?
So first of all, in case the reference was too oblique, I'm pretty sure this is Boba Fett's armor, right?
Yes.
So the Sarlacc ate Boba Fett, right? And the armor is indestructible. Boba Fett is not, so the armor is left over. So there's an interesting legal angle to this because the, on the one hand, Mando demanding this armor, you could just see that as straight up robbery. He's threatening to kill him over the armor. The armor has never personally belonged to Mando. So instead, what we're talking about, if there's a legal element here beyond just robbery, the legal element is cultural property. And there are certain legal frameworks in the United States, mostly based off of, you know, Native American artifacts and things like that. And there are also international frameworks in the realm of international law and war crimes. And I think that there's actually a reasonable analogy to draw here between this Mandalorian armor and artwork that was appropriated by the Nazis from Jews during the Holocaust. Now hear me out. So I know that people make analogies to the Holocaust. It's usually overwrought. This one is not, this one's pretty good. So as big Star Wars nerds will remember, there was a campaign by the Empire before it fell after the explosion of the second Death Star to literally exterminate the Mandalorians. We could call it a genocide, although, you know, and I think that would qualify because it's not necessarily, as we learn in this show, it's not necessarily a race, but it is a culture, and it certainly is a kind of, you know, nationality maybe of some kind, certainly an identifiable group. And they would appropriate the things that they took from the dead Mandalorians. That's a pretty decent analogy to what happened during the Holocaust with the Nazis appropriating things from the Jewish people that they were killing. And there's actually been successful litigation by Jewish survivors of the Holocaust or the descendants of Jewish survivors of the Holocaust to reclaim artifacts, especially artwork. So the most famous case, which wasn't that long ago, that actually made it all the way to the Supreme Court, was a case in which it was Republic of Austria versus Altman, was the descendant of a Holocaust victim who was suing to get a painting by Klimt called the Golden Lady or the Gold Woman back from the Republic of Austria, that following all the aftermath of the war had, you know, claimed it was theirs and was housing it in a museum. The lawsuit was actually regarding the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act and its retroactivity. So it's a little less interesting perhaps for our viewers, but the point is she eventually won, was able to, winning in the Supreme Court allowed her to actually take the Republic of Austria to court in federal district court for the painting. She eventually won, and it is now hanging in the, I'm gonna mispronounce it, New NEUE Gallery in New York City.
Also so, made into a movie starring Ryan Reynolds. So
yes, that's right. That
if you want the Hollywood take on the case. Yes.
The only thing with Fett's armor is that, not to walk too far down the lore path, we don't know exactly how he acquired it. We don't know, for that matter, how his dad Jango acquired his armor. We do know pretty solidly that neither are true Mandalorians. So the question becomes then, if he, you know, killed a Mandalorian, is there a component of Mandalorian culture that allows, you know, say a Mandalorian fights someone else and loses that battle, sort of a test of strength? Does he have a rightful claim to it? We saw that in Star Wars Rebels with the Lasat. Yep. And, you know, Zeb acknowledging that, you know, if a Lasat honor guard was defeated, his bow staff could be handed off to the victor. I don't know if there's an element to that. Certainly we also saw it like an element of it with with Satine taking over the Darksaber after defeating Gar Saxon. So that may be an angle to it. Boba Fett could have easily gotten it by working with the Empire. You know, we know from Empire that he, you know, had no qualms as long as the check cashed, who was behind the job. So there's an open question about that and its connectivity to the Empire and, you know, their pretty obvious genocide of the Mandalorian people. Generally speaking, and Nari kind of hit on this, you can't items of cultural significance are off limits on the battlefield. So for example, like, you know, the US Army can't storm Baghdad, right, and just take a bunch of Iraqi artifacts and send them back to the Smithsonian. That's not the way it works. That's the property of the, you know, the people of Iraq in that example. And so the idea would be that this armor, and by extension, Din Djarin's claim to it, is the property writ large of the Mandalorian people. And, you know, he's allowed in this world to enforce that right by death, which is awesome.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting too, and Nari mentioned this, the kind of, not just the taking of cultural artifacts, but the appropriation of them and kind of making them, you know, the victor's own. And I think, you know, it's what I like is you're seeing that thread kind of pick up from season one with the Beskar, and you see it, you know, when in the opening scenes, when they talk about the Beskar and how Beskar now has this value. And even when you see the Beskar units in season one, you know, they've been melted down and restamped with the Imperial crest. And so that has that metal that is precious to them. I mean, I would think it's, you know, equivalent to something like vibranium in the Wakandan context, you know, that you're not going around stealing this stuff. It's not just money. It's a natural resource. It's a cultural element. It has cultural significance. So now the Empire has kind of appropriated it, made it into these metal blocks. And that's really the Mandalorians to take back. What I think would be an interesting thread, and it'll see, you know, as the season develops, how they play this is, does Din Djarin's thread of Mandalorian creed give him rights to just the Beskar? Does it give him rights to the Beskar and the Boba Fett armor? You know, because we saw that in the previous season, that he's clearly a different type of Mandalorian than Sabine, than other Mandalorians we've seen in previous incarnations. So it'll be interesting to see how that kind of, if they want to go into that much detail.
And Gabby brings up a good point, because I think in the context of the armor, beyond even just the metal itself, like the use of it is significant to the Mandalorians and how it's employed. There's that great shot where he still doesn't know whether Cobb Vanth is or isn't a true Mandalorian. And Vanth like plops down at the table and then takes the helmet off, and Din like stops cold in his tracks, and he's like, he didn't have to say anything, but you know, it's like a big WTF in his mind. And I think on a broader scale, to somebody like Din, a true quote unquote Mandalorian, the use of the armor out there in the galaxy being misused like that dilutes and takes away from his culture. It's sort of like, you know, if Americans were out there with Native American artifacts, just like wearing stuff around that was culturally significant, we think it looks cool and, you know, maybe it serves some functional purpose, but it just kind of tramples on the significance of their culture. You know, I don't want to go down this path too much, but a great example is like sports teams using mascots, right? You know, that the imagery is a lot different than actual cultural property that belonged to somebody. You know, we might say, or somebody, you know, making the argument from the sports team side might say, hey, we're doing this to honor you. We like the idea and the imagery that it presents about strength and honor and that sort of stuff. But that's not for that person to say, you know, it's not yours, and you don't get to bend it to your will just because you think it in some way doesn't insult that culture. And so I think there's a thread of that here. And all of these reasons that Nari, Gabby, and I've brought up are why the protection of cultural property is such a big thing on the battlefield or outside the context of armed conflict, when you're just talking about, you know, say, take your pick of countries where there's government unrest and a new government sweeps in through a coup. There's always an interest in the international community and the protection of those cultural artifacts and property for those same reasons.
Well done. Well, let's take some issues in chronological order, at least when we finally meet the Marshal. And I'll put this out there. I love the Marshal. I hope we see him again, and I hope we see a couple more episodes on Tatooine.
Yeah, be shaking her head. No. She's no, muted.
I don't know. Maybe it's because I've seen, to me, it just seemed like they took Timothy Oliphant and were just like, let's make him a Timothy Oliphant character. Like, it just seemed kind of lame. I said it on Twitter earlier today. This was just not my cup of tea episode. I had a lot of issues with it, storytelling wise. But yeah, no, I was like, he was kind of like, what was the character from last season? The Han kind of knockoff character that he runs into in Tatooine.
Toro Calican.
Yeah, that kid. But it seemed like that was this character for me. I wasn't a fan.
So now I'm not familiar with this other work, because there's only so much pop culture I can absorb. So that might impact my decision if it's like the same character over and over again. But I like the concept of the guy who they're feeling good because the evil empire just lost their second Death Star. They get run over by bandits. He barely escapes. And what's he do when he has a chance for freedom? He goes back and saves his home. And like, he could have gone, that's too bad for them. I'm moving, and go to another part of that horrid desert planet. He goes back and helps build the community. And I liked that, as opposed to I'm packing up and not going back.
Yeah, I'm going to register a vote in favor. I liked this character, and I really liked that backstory because I think like it's a level of nuance and complexity that we don't always get in other Star Wars products, let's say, which is like the big bad empire dissolved, and that's not the end of the story, right? And as often happens, if you're trying to tell a story that registers a little closer to reality, what would happen is in a backwater like Tatooine, other powers might move in, and those powers might actually be worse. So it turns out this group of gangsters or bandits that enslaves the town might actually have made life worse for the people there. And that may have happened in a lot of places where the empire used to exist. And that's a complicated question. I'm not saying that the rebellion wasn't still the right thing to do. Just that, you know, the world is messy.
Well, you also had the fall of the Hutts. Mm-hmm. So you had a double whammy on Tatooine where culture completely flips. And unless you have the revolutionaries there to install the new government, things can go bad very quickly if another group rolls in to go like, well, the Hutts are gone, the empire is gone, we can do whatever we want to these people and they're ours. Like, and the rebellion was strong, but not that strong to deploy forces to state be peacemakers. When necessary.
Especially in the immediate aftermath of the Death Star blowing up.
Like yeah, 20 minutes later.
We saw how long it took the Skywalkers to get back to Tatooine. It was very low on their priority list.
Poor Saps had literally just watched the video of the Death Star blowing up and couldn't even take like a round of shots before like literal laser blasts were cutting them all down. Yeah, but that's an interesting aspect of Tatooine versus like some of the more populated planets like Coruscant, because there is this disconnect from the larger, you know, quote unquote civilized galaxy in the core, the midrim, that Tatooine, even, you know, going back to the prequel days, has no central government. I mean, it's not like, you know, any civilized country that we know, first world country, even second world country that we know here in real life. It's a series of disjointed communities that sort of exist on their own. Tatooine Mos Eisley is different than Anchorhead, is different than Mos Espa. You know, I think they had an informal capital at one point, but really you have a criminal organization in the Hutts providing the only real stability alongside the enforcement mechanism of, you know, a detachment of sand troopers. Sounds like the Empire stationed some folks there after A New Hope for some time, but there really isn't anything. And so like to Gabby and Nari's point, you have this 1-2 punch of destabilization happening within like days of each other in Jabba's death and then the Empire's destruction. And it's fascinating to me, Cobb Vanth's character was introduced a few years ago in the Aftermath trilogy, just as an aside, and people kind of, he had a very tiny part that wasn't connected to the main storyline, and people kind of fixated on it because of the connection to Boba Fett's armor. I never thought we would see him again, but it is fascinating to see somebody, just a random dude, because this guy has like, he's not a true Mandalorian. He's not a former Imperial or Rebel that we know of. This is just a random guy that decided to take the law into his hands. And then suddenly in a vacuum of governmental leadership or authority, he steps up and takes like the mantle of law enforcement and, you know, governing body, for lack of a better term, in this tiny town. and the people just go along with it because he provides them the things that he needs. It's a lot like, and I won't go down the road too deeply, but when I was in Afghanistan, like some of these tiny, tiny villages that were so remote and disconnected from the capital in Kabul, that was sort of the norm. You know, they didn't care that there was a central government, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of miles away from them. You know, they had some local authority, whether it be like an elected official or somebody they had just sort of appointed, like an elder. And so long as they were provided for in terms of security and justice and basic needs, they were okay with it. And that's what I like about Cobb Vanth's character. It's sort of,
he doesn't pervert anything. It's like, hey, I came back to help and stuck around doing it. Like, that's, again, that's a very Old West type story. And okay, he did ask for a drink and I don't know if he paid for it, so there could be an issue there. But on the flip side, when I was in high school and worked at a movie theater, we gave police and fire free tickets to movies. And because, again, it's like, yeah, your job is to get shot at or go into a burning building. The movie's on our company. Thank you. Have a good, because that's like civil society. The flip side of this is,
I would also bet that he has a tab at that bar. I'm just going to hazard a guess.
I'm okay with that. It's that Old West type situation. And, when we see him talking to the town about the danger of the dragon, it's like, what if it hits the school? Like,
that really got me, guys.
It was so funny.
Oh, random. I was like, that and the Dag Nabbit by Mando, like, totally broke story for me, because I was like, what? There's a school? What? Like, this is too, it's far out of the Star Wars realm and too, like, Western-y for me. Yeah. And plus, can we talk about how that town is just like, they put up like a little bit of resistance. They're like, oh no, like, don't work with the Tusken Raiders. And then they're like, okay, whatever. Like, they say it's okay. There's a peace treaty. So he probably walked in. He's like, I'm sheriff now. And there was somebody like, okay, like,
whatever. He's got armor and he's got a gun, so.
I don't want to do it. You want to do it? Okay. It's
like, exactly.
Yeah, and it's Bob, and everyone's happy at that point. Like, again, I didn't mind the Old West feel because I like the Old West stories. So, and if people live there, they're going to be procreating. You need something for the kids to do. And
Star Wars, people don't go to school.
I know, but that's one of the things that I like about this one, is that it has that little element that's different from other Star Wars. And like, yeah, if you have an actual village, why, like, what do the kiddos do all day? I also thought it was just really comedic. Like, it just did get thrown in there. It's kind of like, it would have been even more on the nose if instead he's like, but what about if it hit the nursery? Like, you can't let it do that.
Not our orphanage.
I thought that was humorous enough that I enjoyed it breaking. I agree it was a little absurd. I enjoyed it enough that I forgave it.
You would think Star Wars learned their lesson of putting young children in school.
Yeah, the Jedi are the only ones allowed to have an academy.
Oh, God.
What happened to the younglings last time? Yeah.
And maybe that's the warning label. It's like, no.
Don't go to school.
We're really sensitive about schools because there was some pleasantness about 25 years ago, and everyone's still upset about what happened. Yeah.
Look, you will be illiterate, but you won't be eaten by a crate dragon. So.
And you won't be slaughtered.
It's a win-win.
Yeah.
Everything's going to be okay. So we're still at the beginning. So at the bar, we have the, I think, a nice way of telling the backstory, that they're riding on their swoop bikes, and we get the background. So like it wasn't background at the bar because the story wouldn't be moving forward at that point. So like just from the storytelling perspective, instead of showing them riding the bikes continuously, we get the backstory. Favreau once again works in the ice cream maker as the safe. And again, that just warms my heart, especially seeing how he talked about that in the documentary about the making. So again, just making sweet love to the audience and God bless them for doing that.
Also, I loved the prequel like nod with the bike from the pod racing, kind of contraption.
Yeah, that
bike.
Is what it
I was like. Yes, my childhood.
Again, it was well done. It's like, how many nerd references can we work in? Well, so we have him, they're getting shot at because they're getting raided. And he steals from the people who are killing everyone. He didn't know what he was grabbing. He just grabbed something hoping that, you know, I would think he was hoping it was food or water, not necessarily cash, because cash is worthless in the desert. Until
turns out not so much, but yeah. And, okay,
you know, a sandcrawler finding you and they didn't run him over, so yay. But we have him do a wonderful lesson in contracts, because he buys the armor off the Jawas with those crystals. And Gabby, you, I believe, also made notes with this, but we have the elements of the Jawas want the crystals. They're saying, do you want this droid, which looks oddly out of Disneyland with one of the droid builder kits, but maybe I'm imagining that. And
now available at Galaxy's Edge.
Yeah. Just, again, that doesn't bother me.
Galaxy's Edge online.
It's just, I mean, again, we all have to do Christmas shopping. So, I mean, we're easy to shop for. So, but we have an offer acceptance, you know, the consideration of crystals for the armor. What are your thoughts on whether or not this could be a valid contract, purchase contract?
Well, what I liked is that, like you said, you saw kind of negotiation happening. And first he gets the water and he's chugging the water. And then he kind of realizes, he's like, wait, these crystals don't equate to water. Like it's not an even trade. And so he says, I want the armor too. And so I think that was a good negotiation, because if he had just stopped there, he would have purchased a flask or a sleeve or whatever they call it of water for, you know, however much these crystals were. And he said, he countered and said, no, I also want this. So he did kind of this modification counter offer in the midst of getting his sanity back when he's drinking water.
Be like buying a bottle of Fiji water. That'll cost you all your crystals.
Yeah.
Again, so, it's like he hasn't slept, hasn't eaten, it's rehydrated. It's like, wait, I'll take that.
Yeah. Which you could go ahead.
Oh, you first, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, you could throw in an idea that he may not have been competent to make a contract when he first gets the water. And he realizes that he has to kind of strike a new bargain. When he's in of sound mind and body, because when you're so dehydrated and tired, you're not of sound mind and body. So he gets the water. He's like, aha, they have the armor. I'm going to take that for my crystals instead.
I was just going to ask the group, now what if the bandits sue him for converting their crystals?
The dead ones?
You know, they
that's the benefit of murdering your the opposing party.
not that was not legal advice, listeners. Just gonna throw that out there.
No,
it's like, so let me back up. You killed my friends. You shot my buddy. I wasn't able to get him out, but you enslaved him and all the others, and you're upset. Screw you.
I mean, stranger things have happened. I could see them suing maybe not for conversion, but for some kind of other bizarre, like, you know, type of taking. Because I mean, like, recently you have in Kentucky the officers who are suing the boyfriend of Breonna Taylor for, I think, emotional distress or something. And it's like, it's just, that's the thing I think, you know, all of this kind of hinges on, is that, yes, you can bring these kinds of cases. Like, is it going to go forward? Meh, you know, it's unclear. But like, you can bring as crazy a suit as you want, you know, I mean, your lawyer may get in trouble for ethics violations, but, you know, you can kind of do that. But I'd love to see some, like, girl, you know, wife of the dead bandits be like, you stole my crystals.
This is one of those conversations you have with clients where you kind of size up the, you know, the opposing party, and you're like, you know, I understand you have damages, but mm-hmm. what are you likely to regain? He can't mm-hmm. barf up that water that he traded your crystals for. And, you know, maybe if Boba Fett's armor is true Beskar, then it really is valuable. And so it may be worth going after in litigation. But if it's not, if it's just some beat up armor that's been like half digested by a Sarlacc, you know, you're going to end up spending more in litigation than mm-hmm. you're ever going to recover. Cobb Vanth doesn't look like he's exactly rolling in the credits out there in Mos Pelgo. And
he doesn't have that Mon Calamari flan.
Yeah, I doubt it. And so he's probably what we would call judgment proof, and, you know, has little in the way of assets to, you know, even if they did get a victory in court against him.
Yeah. I feel like that's probably 50% of our jobs as lawyers, is just telling clients, like, yes, no. I know you're upset, but like,
no,
what you're upset about and what the court can actually do about it are like way, way far apart. Like, unfortunately.
I was just going to throw in there, perhaps unclean hands as a legal doctrine. you know, it's doubtful that a judge is going to entertain your lawsuit if you're suing for conversion of the thing that you stole. and the crystals they stole from the village, right? It's a village of miners. Yeah, yeah.
We don't know what they're mining on Tatooine, so. The fact that there are
What were those crystals? Did they mention the name?
Yeah, they're silicax, which is something that didn't. Well, to my knowledge, it was introduced in the Aftermath trilogy, like in Cobb Vanth's backstory. They used the same backstory, so he had stolen the same crystals in the book. If they appeared in Legends EU somewhere, I don't know.
I don't. And I'm happy either way. It's you know, it brings me joy, and that's what matters.
Thanks for entertaining that line of reasoning, guys.
I will say they looked very cool, and if when it's safe to go back down to Disney World again or Disneyland, Galaxy's Edge introduces like edible silicax crystals. They're like rock candy. I would buy some.
And they. Downtown
they somehow light up.
Yes.
You eat them out of an ice cream machine.
That's right. Yep.
It's a pandemic.
Make it alcoholic. Yeah. So,
since there's a pandemic, and I'm not going to go drive 400 miles to go to Downtown Disney, because they have the Galaxy's Edge outpost in Downtown Disney for my Kyber crystal needs and any other swag. I'm not going to do that, but it is an option. And I do know people down there who we could send on an away mission to. Yeah.
Gabriella, I just want to throw in there really quick, a great adult use of rock candy is get one of those sticks of rock candy and use it as a stirrer for your cocktail.
Nari
things
is wise.
To do in quarantine.
Was that an elective at Stanford, Nari, or did you put
that No, up? But I did grow up in Arizona, where rock candy is like a state thing.
Oh, Okay, that makes more sense. So,
yes.
All righty. Well, let's talk about defense of the town. So we have our marshal goes back and saves the town. And I love this because we I'll go through what the law is. In California, we have California Civil Code 50, which goes back to the founding of the state, that says any necessary force may be used to protect from wrongful injury the person or property of oneself or of a wife, husband, child, parent, or other relative or a member of one's family or a ward, servant, master, or guest. And it's actually more expansive than that currently. He goes back and saves the town. Thomas, was that legally valid?
Yeah, I think the concept of self-defense is expandable. It's, you know, the idea in the law is you're not limited to using force to defend just your body, right? A good example would be your family. I mean, you know, if the law were that restrictive that you could only use force to defend yourself, the idea that you would get in trouble, say, for protecting, I don't know, a random school full of kids in a desert school somewhere seems absurd. The idea that you couldn't protect your own children or somebody that couldn't defend themselves in your family would be absurd. So the law does allow you to extend that doctrine, extend that ability and defend others to the same extent. You effectively put yourself in their shoes, so you don't get an unlimited right to use force, but to the extent that they're able legally to use force to defend themselves, you can step in and defend them on their behalf. And so, in terms of the threat that the crate dragon posed, I think we would call that threat of death or grievous bodily injury. I don't think there's a gray area there. And, it seemed fairly imminent. I don't know how long a crate dragon goes between feedings, but it seems like this is sort of a regular thing for Mos Pelgo, this crate dragon coming in and eating things or people. And clearly the Mandalorian and Cobb Vanth both see an attack happen, albeit one on a creature? A Bantha, thank you. I can think of all these other obscure facts, but then one very obvious creature I can't. Yeah, so I think they're able to step into the shoes. The question is going to be, they take the fight to the crate dragon. And, you know, we're talking a thing and not, or like a creature and not, you know, another sentient being. So that the legal analysis, I guess, is a little bit different. But, I think there is an open question about the imminency of the threat. Obviously, it's different, and I don't think that the same rationale and analysis applies because it's an animal, like you're going after a creature like that. But if this were like a human attacking the town and you're not currently being attacked and you go out prospectively or preemptively and go attack this other human, you're probably going to be in trouble. There's not an unlimited right to self-defense there.
Let's go back to the dragon at the end, because there's some research that I tossed in, but I was speaking about the bandits who had enslaved the town, because he goes...
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. It's fine. I get way off on this crate dragon thing.
Yeah.
In terms of the bandits, I think, again, it's the problem for Cobb Vanth is temporal, right? It's a time problem. He escaped. They've got, I guess to the extent that there are still folks living under the gun of these bandits, there's some threat to life or property, and he's trying to free them. But my question would be, what threat are they posing? I think, the question of freeing them from slavery probably makes it pretty clear that he's able to go in. They're effectively kidnapped, so he's able to go in and defend them against the threat of death, presumably that they're under.
Yeah. See, he did more than the Jedi in The Phantom Menace to go stop slavery on Tatooine. That's true. So,
not like Qui-Gon's approach of, well, we can't do everything.
We're just going to leave your mom a slave. We'll be fine. Yeah.
This will have no effect on your long term. I'm not damning the galaxy right now. Like, she'll be okay.
She's your mom.
Look, you've got a lot of midichlorians. You can come back sometime.
Oh, God.
And you'll come back very peaceful and just liberate her. And it'll be glorious because you will bring balance to the Force.
No, he didn't do that. I'm going to go save my friends. So I'm comfortable backing that legally in an Old West situation of, well, I went in and shot all the bad guys.
Yeah.
Well, and so you first, Gabby.
I think what's interesting too is that, you know, it kind of circles back to our conversation that we had in episode 1, season 1 of bounty hunters and how they act as a kind of quasi law enforcement. And here you have Cobb Vanth before he becomes the marshal. Acting as a quasi law enforcement. He's being judge, jury, and executioner to these guys. And I think he kind of transitions because you say, well, he kind of just takes over in this kind of old tiny sheriff way because nobody really opposes him. But in theory, you could consider that an elected sheriff position, that he's theoretically elected by the town when they don't object, their silence is consent. And he now has more kind of law enforcement powers after the fact. So when he does go after the crate dragon, circling back to Thomas's point, even if that was a human that was attacking the town, he would have more leeway and more powers as a law enforcement officer than he would when he initially comes back to the town as just kind of this vigilante, you know, kind of Batman style, like, I'm going to clear the town of all these bad guys, you know. So I think that's an important distinction in his roles and responsibilities, that kind of election to sheriff position.
That was basically what I was going to go for. Nicely done, Gabby.
And you know, to keep things in the Disney family for a Marvel or Star Wars reference, let's go with Moon Knight, you know, just for that double whammy right there. So, And speaking of dragons, let's go out for the contract that they come up with to, I will give you back this armor instead of us having a shootout if you help me kill the dragon. I broke out Murray on contracts and opened up to
no!
Did I trigger you, Gabby? Are you okay?
A million voices suddenly cried out.
I keep coming back and I keep getting triggered to first year contracts. Why do I put myself through this? Why?
Sorry. Hug the child. Safe place. It can't hurt you right now. There we go. You're safe here. So we have an old view of contracts versus what became, you know, the more normal view of independent contract covenants versus bilateral agreements. So the original view was if you had two different contracts or agreements for help me kill the dragon, I will give you the armor, both parties have to perform. And in the old days, it was performance was independent unless the parties in express terms indicated the performance was on some specific way dependent upon performance by the other covenant. Well, that would make no sense because both would have to perform regardless. And like one is dependent upon the other. You got to kill the dragon first before I'm giving you the armor, because I can help you if I'm wearing the armor. I can't help you if you just take it and put it in the Razor Crest and, you know, we try to go kill the dragon together now. I thought that was awesome, just as a nice description of contracts on because it's a pure contract for help me kill the dragon, you get the armor.
My thought as I was watching, and I'll throw this to the group, but at what point during that siege, for lack of a better term, desperate ploy, at what point constitutes substantial performance on behalf of the Mandalorian? Had they not completed the job and just bugged out? Is it detonation of the explosives? Is it him getting eaten?
I would say it's detonation of the initial, the belly explosions, because I think, right. You know, and we've kind of talked about this before in terms of the idea of like the fixer upper type issue, where you've contracted to renovate the house. And then, you know, as always happens on the fixer upper show, they discover like there's mold in the walls or, you know, some bizarre thing like that. And now it's going to cost you $3,000 more. Well, that's an unforeseen circumstance. They didn't know, you know, all their information said that blowing up the belly was going to, you know, kind of end the whole thing. So that was, they would almost have to, you know, either renegotiate, or obviously things are happening on the fly. And then, you know, once all the dust settles, then some apartment.
Literal dust. Literal dust.
The dust settles, a party may be dead, so then they don't have to perform. You know, they may have changed circumstances, the thing may ultimately be dead, and as was the case, and the contract's fine. So, you know, it just, I think that was substantial performance, and everything after was just like kind of unforeseen, you know. And then he obviously saves the day by doing like a kind of Jonah and the whale.
And he didn't have, he's like, what's your plan? I don't know, you know.
Get eaten.
It's like, I have 12% of a plan. Like, he was putting it together in real time. And he did think enough to say, take care of the kid. So he was planning for the worst case outcome.
Yeah. Which I think, to me, that moment was, you know, because the shot cuts to Baby Yoda like freaking out when Dad gets eaten by the dragon, and he's like, "No, Daddy, where'd you go?" That's a classic case of bystander emotional distress, because this is his child. He's seeing Dad get eaten by a dragon, and that is literally the classic case, that seeing somebody either die or get severely wounded in front of you, that's a loved one, that is the classic negligent infliction of emotional distress. So he could have sued the dragon or the dragon's handlers or whoever is controlling the dragon.
It seems like the court would have a hard time exercising jurisdiction over a crate dragon.
Well, that, and it's a moot point because the remedy was discovered out of court.
Yes.
Don't Dad worry, we got this. Fine.
You forfeit your pearl.
Seeing Daddy fly out of the dragon it's, again, pure Star Wars, just glorious. Well, let's talk about the contract modification that happens with bringing in the Tusken Raiders, because we have this bilateral agreement, and then the Tusken Raiders come in. My thought is this a new agreement, or was the first one modified, or was, what do we have here? Do we just have different agreements that are playing that are dependent upon killing the dragon? And who would like to take the first bite at this?
So I'm happy so that Gabby doesn't have more triggering from contracts, although you handled the last one really, really well. But I will just put out there that I'm very jealous, by the way. I want one of those. But I will just put out there that I think this was an easy contract amendment, first of all, because normally what you need for amendment is just the agreement of the original two parties. And since the original two parties were the Marshall and Mando, and they're both getting there and thinking, we're going to die if we try to fulfill this contract. It's a pretty easy one to go off of. But also the part where we're going to die if we try to fulfill this contract lends itself to, you know, the impossibility idea that through unforeseen circumstances, in this case, the unforeseen circumstance is, this is about three times as large as we thought it was going to be. they now realize that they can't actually fulfill the contract under its original terms. In which case, right, they basically could have both breached, just decided not to fulfill it and created a new contract. But I think this is an easy amendment just because they both would have agreed to it. Adding the Tusken Raiders, I think, is also pretty easy. They were there. They agreed to it. Volunteering the town. Yeah, you know, I actually think under the analysis that Gabby was going through before about where the marshal actually could have been the elected sheriff, he is in fact, right, an officer of the peace, law enforcement. And this kind of goes to the old Wild West law. One of the things about that was the ability to gather a posse. and I've talked a lot about this in other podcasts and other shows, but you know, the old common law idea was that you would put out the hue and cry and all able-bodied men had to come assist the officer of the peace in executing the law or making the arrest. So, you know, the marshal may have been able to volunteer the villagers because they would have been compelled to respond to his call to bring the great dragon to justice. Not so much Mando. We'll just let that slide though.
Yeah.
Great, yeah, posse.
I was just thinking that because Mando doesn't have the authority to create the posse, to rally the posse, that the marshal would have. And if you think about it, if you kind of slow down that scene, he agrees on behalf of the town and the marshal to other parties to bring this party into an agreement with the Tusken Raiders. And granted, because before he was doing kind of a translation of what the Tusken Raiders were saying, at that point, he's just like, no. And they throw down the rocks and he's like, oh, where'd you get these people from? And he's like, I volunteered your village. Great. but, you know, he entered all those parties unknowingly, especially the village, into this agreement. Can he do that? Like, he's conscripted this army. He's rallied this posse without them knowing it. And I think you could, in a way, consider that, I don't know necessarily a breach, but definitely bad faith in his original agreement with the marshal, that he's acting in bad faith there because he's not acting, because the way to act in good faith there with his original agreement with the marshal would have been to translate what the Tusken Raiders were saying, we need more people. And he tells the marshal, well, the best idea would be you have these villagers, you have the extra people. Do you agree to conscript these people for this task? Yes, okay, that would have been all kind of above board. I don't think that's the little kind of sketchy part there.
I like that he effectively forces Cobb to exercise that Wild West law enforcement authority to do it. Because you don't see Din go in and say, hey, you guys are all going to fight a dragon. It's Cobb that sort of leads that discussion. And so he sort of subsumes Cobb's role in that negotiation. My favorite part of that scene is how they argue about the scale of the sand table that they've laid out. that's the major issue. And then, like, where are all these other rocks from?
It is to scale. It's like, oh. Oh no, that was not the answer I wanted.
I loved the kind of subtle translator jokes that were happening, which I'm sure Pedro Pascal as a bilingual person kind of enjoyed as well. There's a great sketch from Comedy Central of the world's worst translator. And I recommend everybody go on YouTube and watch it. It's hilarious. And it just kind of highlights that issue of things going back and forth so quickly. But one of the things I just wanted to point out is this is the second time we've seen the Tusken Raiders, and Din Djarin acting as kind of this diplomat with the Raiders, where everybody's kind of nixing them and saying, you know, no, they're, you know, savages and they're, you know, evil and, you know, they raid our villages and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He's like, no, they can be rationed with, they can be talked to, like, they are people. You know, he even says, you know, this is the custom, right? Like, drink the water. He's like, now you've insulted him because you haven't drunk the water, even though it stinks. Like, this is just kind of cultural. He's almost like a cultural diplomat, which I think is interesting. Unfortunately, he has no legal standing to back up that cultural diplomat role, which would change, I think, if he had some sort of legal authority as a cultural diplomat to conscript the posse, right? he would have been acting as kind of this mediator, this kind of third party figure in interacting with the two parties. But unfortunately, he doesn't have that legal backing for him.
And Justin's, oh, you first, Tom.
No, I was just going to make the comment that I do love that as the Sand People come into town, they are riding single file, as Tusken Raiders do, to hide their numbers.
I was going to bring that up too, so yes.
And I just wanted to add that this was one of the things that I love most about The Mandalorian, specifically among various Star Wars stories, is that, you know, in a lot of Star Wars, it can be very black and white. You get a lot of very simple narratives, not, you know, much less so outside of the main films. And there's been a lot of really good stories written around that. But this is just such a great example. Like the stereotype is that in Star Wars, the bad thing that looks like the bad thing is just the bad thing. If it looks like a monster, it's a monster. In Star Trek, right, the stereotype is anything that looks like a monster actually isn't. You got to look harder, try to talk to it, something. And in this case, right, in early on, it started not just with the Sand People, but even with their dogs, mm-hmm. where they look super scary, they look super violent, and then it turns out that, no, they're actually just dogs. And they want to have their chin scratched.
Yeah,
it was so much fun. You clearly can tell that Favreau had Sand People as action figures.
Yes.
Yeah, because
a lot of them.
Yeah, he joked about, you know, like being the younger brother and getting all the B grade toys. And it's just like, okay, you are living out childhood fantasies that you had with your action figures, with your storytelling, and I adore it. I enjoy the Tusken Raiders aren't just savages angle a lot. And I think that also plays into the view of the Old West, like watching a cowboy movie from the 1950s versus one of today. It's radically different in how Native Americans are portrayed. And I think they took a lesson from that here. Is the clear message, and I like that a lot. So, which brings us to
the monster that is a monster.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the governments can authorize wild animals that are dangerous to be killed, and then, you know, California law gets into, if there is, you know, a county board of elected officials can authorize the destruction of gophers, squirrels, or wild animals, noxious weeds, plant diseases, or insects that are injurious to fruit or trees.
Murder hornets.
Yeah, murder hornets. I remember
just thinking of murder hornets.
When I was a kid in the 80s, long before I think all of you were born, there was fruit flies in California, and we had nightly helicopters fly over and spray them to kill them. And nowadays, if we did something like that, there would be people freaking out for weird conspiracies like it's contrails.
The government needed to do something with all that extra Agent Orange from Vietnam.
They didn't firebomb Los Altos. Okay, like, let's be very clear.
Just get rid of it in California.
Take it out. Yeah.
No, yeah. But I think you see, because in that scenario, Josh, that would be like the government. That would be, you know, kind of a Department of Public Health or an environmental division, either local or state, taking care of that. But I think you've seen it, you know, from my home state in Florida. You know, we had that when we had python and snake infestations. I mean, the state government was like, you can go out and kill these things, like kill it, load it up, let us know you got it, you know, great. And you even saw this, I think a funnier example was in Puerto Rico. They had an iguana infestation. And it was so bad that not only did the government authorize people to go slay iguanas, which are in their own form a little form of a dragon.
But the
government not only authorized people to go kill iguanas, but they included a helpful recipe for iguana meat. So iguanas, and there were restaurants buying iguana meat.
Oh my god.
Your side hustle.
And you had the same thing, not obviously cooking snake meat in Florida, but there was monetary kind of reward, which kind of circles back to this whole arc here in this episode, is that there's a benefit to Din for killing the dragon. There's obviously the peace benefit to the town and to the raiders, but he gets kind of a
literal cut. Like,
yeah, he gets a cut. He gets a cut of the and a kind of monetary benefit. But you also see the Tuscan Raiders doing that kind of iguana, like they're chopping it up. They're gonna have a barbecue. Like, it's gonna be great. Like, I got the pearl. You know, all that kind of good stuff.
Well, they're gonna eat for a long time, and they.
Oh yeah, I was really happy that they got to work right away, because I was like, they could probably survive for two generations off that if you dried that real quick.
So there's that factor. I will toss in, law enforcement has a proud history of killing wild, dangerous animals that are terrorizing towns, or in some cases highly traumatic. Again, I didn't watch Tiger King, but I did listen to podcasts about it.
You should.
Cultural icon.
Bringing it back to the start of the pandemic.
But the idea of like tigers getting out in Ohio or wherever it is, and you know, those poor police officers that had to go out and kill them, and just imagine going home going like, I had to shoot a tiger today. I don't feel proud about what I did. And like that would be rough.
Unless you're Carol Baskin.
Yeah, this was.
I had to kill a human man today, but I feel pretty good about it. He had it coming to him.
I mean, it's not like they had tiger jerky afterwards, because again, that
was. According to Joe Exotic, there were tiger burgers made of some kind.
Oh no.
Oh my god.
Oh, that's horrendous.
Oh god, no. Anyway.
Like I said, cultural icon.
Everyone's gonna need therapy. This was within the marshal's responsibility to go like, we're gonna go out and kill this thing because it's going after kids. And we have a really, really strict rules in our society now since the unpleasantness happened at that school on Coruscant.
We protect schools at all costs.
And I wasn't gonna do anything about that dragon, but you brought up the school, and so I'm all in.
We all heard the story. We all know about it. Yeah. It's just, we were all kids.
We just made it. The story just made it to us, like 2 years ago.
Wait, what happened?
We're freshly traumatized.
You mean Anakin from Mos Espa? Little Anakin did that?
Yeah.
No, I don't believe that.
The pod racing champion.
The Anakin that I got my speeder from? That this.
But it's so nice.
This is what we get for recording on a Friday night.
Yeah. So yeah, I could see people on Tatooine being really hip to make sure school children are safe.
Yes. So,
that was one of ours.
Schools are dragon-free zones.
Never again. Oh god, I'm so wrong. I'm grateful it's back. Now, Thomas.
Wait, I just want to add in closing on the crate dragon stuff. For people who may have been less familiar with it, the only place I think a crate dragon was mentioned during, like, you know, the movie trilogies was there was a skeleton of one that appeared in one of the movies. But if you were like me and played all those Knights of the Old Republic games, you in fact fought crate dragons and you created a lightsaber out of the pearl of one. So yes, the thing that it holds up at the end is a pearl, not an egg. It is made of kyber and you can make lightsabers out of it. There we go.
You win tonight's Star Wars fandom contest.
Doesn't always happen. I'm pretty happy that I get one.
Yeah, that was very impressive because I looked in my alien guide and the crate dragons aren't in there. I was actually really surprised by that. But there's a picture of the skeleton one by talking about the Tusken Raiders and life on Tatooine.
And that's the cry that Obi-Wan uses to scare off the Tusken Raiders from Luke is a crate dragon call.
Oh man. Okay. I lost the contest again, Tom. That was too good. Yeah.
It's been edited like three. Now it sounds different than if you go back and watch like the special edition or the original version. It sounded very different over the years, but
it's a love letter to what we saw in A New Hope about Tatooine, and I don't know how much of it is tied to the toys that John Favreau had as a child, or if he just felt like, here's a great storytelling opportunity. But let's talk about the reveal at the end on who was that old man. And Thomas, why don't we go for you on who do you think that was?
Man, that was none other than Boba Fett looking beat up. It looks like he escaped the Sarlacc minus his eyebrows. So it takes a Sarlacc 1,000 years to digest you. And I guess they start with your hair. So, you know, unfortunately he didn't escape fully unscathed, but he's looking a little haggard and pissed off and is clearly in search of his armor. I would suppose, since he's, you know, watching Mando. I don't think it's obviously not Django, because Django lost his head. Yeah. And it doesn't make any sense that it's some other old clone trooper. So this is Boba Fett that we see at the end.
Yeah, which, I mean, like they probably, especially if it's the actor playing him, but he did look, I think, a little older than he should be. But the twin sons of Tatooine do age people more.
Also Sarlacc guts.
Yeah. Because Obi-Wan should not have looked as old as he did as Alec Guinness, but that was hard living. Gabby, your thoughts?
I've ever since they announced the casting of Temuera Morrison, I just thought it was super cool, because it really is, you know, even though it probably is Boba Fett, it's so open because he's the clone. He's the original clone. So there's any number of ways they can go with it.
It'd be cool if it was Captain Rex.
Yeah. I mean, it's so open and it can be anything. And I think that was also one of the things that was super cool for me is we got most of the trailer footage that we've gotten was in this first episode. So
yeah, very true.
I mean, I think the only thing we haven't seen is the kind of snow planet, the return of Cara and Greef, which we already kind of knew was going to happen. And that kind of water area that Mando and Baby Yoda go to. But other than that, like the most of the dialogue was in all the dialogue we got from the trailer was in this episode. So like, I think that was pretty cool because it just leaves so much open for the next, what is it? What are we getting? Eight episodes?
Yeah, that's a great point, because before this episode, we'd seen like, what, 3 minutes of footage total, if you crammed everything together. And, you know, I think about like a normal Star Wars movie at this point. Well, prior to release, you'd have what, 3 trailers? A dozen or so TV spots, a sizzle reel, you know, we'd have seen like a good 6 or 7 minutes of footage. So to have a fraction of that, we really don't know what's coming, which is awesome. And they're not doing screener copies this year. With the first season, there were a group of people that got early access to each episode each week, and that's not happening this year. So that's probably for a variety of reasons, but it's awesome to think that on Friday at midnight, we are all equally situated.
Good. I like being surprised.
And I love that this is going to get us most of the way through 2020.
Yes.
And then we have WandaVision to close out 2020. So two big properties kind of like saying, who cares about movies? We have television shows.
It's bizarre. I was thinking about before we got on the recording how weird and simultaneously awesome it is that we've been without movies that we've known that were supposed to come out, stuff like Black Widow and the new Top Gun movie, or you take your pick, that would have been on home release, that like we would have been able to stream those movies by now. They've been delayed indefinitely. A ton of TV shows have been delayed indefinitely. You know, I think about, you know, like Handmaid's Tale, like we might get to see that next year. I don't know. And somehow they were able to get Mandalorian complete. And then I'm really looking forward as well to WandaVision. So I feel like this is like divine intervention that we get some new Star Wars to close out 2020.
Agreed.
The Force wills it.
Mm-hmm. This is the way.
Thank the maker.
This is the way.
This is the way.
It is. I just feel object joy, and I'm very grateful for it, because Star Wars works, I think, better as serialized storytelling this way. And the fact we get a Marvel show, which again, some of these characters, I think it's a benefit to have more time with them for development and storytelling purposes. So it's not just show up and look cool in a pose, it's actually you understand them. So it's all good stuff. So with that, everyone, thank you for tuning in. We definitely will be talking about The Mandalorian all of November and probably all of December at this rate. So that's a good thing. And everyone, stay healthy, stay safe, and be sure to take your ballot to an actual drop box or the polling station.
Vote.
Go vote.
We haven't actually endorsed a candidate before, but I'm kind of comfortable doing that this time around. So everyone, vote. Take care, and we'll see you all soon.